This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hey everyone, Ray here, and I've got a new book recommendation for you. When Hazel Ying Lee's U.S. Army plane went down in a Texas field during World War II, the farmer chased her around the plane with a pitchfork. First, because he thought she was Japanese, and second, because female flyers were only just beginning to fly in the Air Corps. This is one of the remarkable events in the life of Lee, revealed in a new biography, American Fly Girl, by Susan Tate Ankeny. Born in Portland, Oregon in 1912, inspired by Amelia Earhart and America's fledgling aviation industry, Lee was fearless, talented, and driven. She followed her passion to fly, working to earn her pilot's license. She was the only Chinese-American pilot in the legendary WASPs, highly trained civilians delivering military planes for the war effort. Lee also faced repeated discrimination. As the child of Chinese immigrants, because of the Chinese Exclusionary Act, as a woman, as an American, and even posthumously as a civilian. But her passion for flying would never abate. She would open doors for women in aviation, although not immediately. It would be another 30 years before women were allowed to fly military aircraft in the U.S. Air Force, and another year before Congress finally granted the WASPs military status and eventually veteran status. The life of the great Hazel Ying Lee, American Fly Girl, from Kensington Publishing, is available everywhere books are sold. Hello, and thank you for listening to the History of World War II podcast, episode 462, When Fighting for Your Life, You Can Never Go Too Far. Last time, through a series of luck and back-breaking work, the German-Romanian offensive heading towards Odessa had been delayed enough to allow multiple defensive rings to be carved into the earth around the city. Still, the Axis forces came closer, while the various Soviet rifle divisions fell back. And now that all the defenders were behind some kind of line or another, the enemy forces began to throw themselves at these lines, their objective being to enter Odessa. Having said that, the Stavka knew that one of three things would happen. Odessa would hold out, or it would not, or it would remain defiant long enough to launch raids against the Romanian oil fields, hopefully shifting the focus of Bucharest and Berlin. But no serious Soviet officer could think that Odessa would remain defiant for the rest of this war. That seemed, for all intents and purposes, impossible. On August 11th and 12th, the Axis launched 9 major attacks at some part of the outer line. Problem was, all the digging that had been done by civilians, leaving the troops relatively fresh. And in that state, they stopped all those attacks while killing at least 4,000 attackers. The Axis were smart enough to bring tanks to where they could, but ended up losing tank crews and tanks as the desperate Soviets used anti-tank artillery and the up-touch close of Molotov cocktails. These measures destroyed 13 German tanks, and 7 Axis planes were removed from the sky by Soviet fighters. Not that this could go on forever, but the defenders were starting out well, knowing well what would happen to them if Odessa fell. Not that the invaders did not keep on encroaching, ever closer through no man's land, to the closest defensive line, which meant that the Soviet troops, when not fighting, continued the siege works, as it was now too dangerous to have that many civilians nearby. Mostly what they worked on was improving, i.e. widening and deepening the anti-tank ditches. Not that the civilians' work was over. Within the city, though on its edges, barricades continued to be built, as were anti-tank obstacles and other fortifications. Even if the enemy got this far, their fight would not be over. The Stavka realized this early on, that attrition was one of their better weapons. Cruel? Yes, but in the defense of the state, very little was left out of bounds. As the outermost Soviet defenders were some 20 kilometers from the city's edge, that meant for now, its occupants were safe from artillery fire. Zooming out, basically the defense of Odessa had an estuary on either side or either end, the modern-day Dniester to the southwest of Odessa and the Azov Lake to the northeast. Back to the fighting, as these nine rather large thrusts had not prevailed, the Romanians, starting on August 12th, reduced their attacks to groups of one or two battalions, backed by tanks, of course. Several sections were hit, but nothing came of it. Then it seemed that that had not been the plan all along. After those areas were hit and repulsed, for the next 2 days, Axis artillery shells targeted those same points along the Soviet defenses, to be followed up by more attacks, but something closer to the original, larger offensives. But these too were held back with blood spilt on both sides, though fighting and loss of life was more intense to the east of Odessa. Again, just outside today's small Azov Lake estuary to the north of Odessa, the fighting had been most fierce, and the Romanians managed to push some of the defending units back. But when these men learned that they had been the weakest point, they literally threw themselves at the Romanians again and again until the lines were back to where they were. This was heroic, but many more dead had to be dealt with. Besides, as these attacks went on, other Axis formations continued spreading along the half-circle front until their farthest man, to the west and east of Odessa on August 13th, was standing next to the Black Sea. The Odessa fortress and all its landlines were cut off from the wider war. And with all these land routes cut off outside of the Odessa lines, the only way to leave or enter the city was by sea. But the Black Sea fleet would do more than just resupply the defenders of Odessa. No, they would participate in any way they could assist. With all the land routes cut off, it was only a matter of time before the Romanian Navy, with the help of German planes, attempted to cut off the port city. It was the Soviet Black Sea fleet's job to not only counter this, but to go on the attack themselves, hitting Romanian port cities, thus making it harder for them to launch attacks. But given that the immediate threat was from the land, some naval units were put ashore with their weapons to help with the defenses here. As for the ships themselves, their larger guns were to help keep the enemy away from the coastal army. But if all this and more failed, the last act of the Black Sea Fleet was to undertake to evacuate all who could be before the enemy was inside the city. This podcast could not exist without the help of sponsors like Yahoo Finance. When it comes to your financial future, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, you've invested all that you can. Now, you need to take those investments to the next level by using what every financial great uses, Yahoo Finance. I've stressed this in my podcast about command and control, which is exactly what Yahoo Finance is. You can see all your investments and retirement accounts in one place. You can consolidate your views from multiple accounts into one hub and access the expert analysis you need to tend to your entire portfolio with confidence. Yahoo Finance has been around for more than 25 years, and they've worked things out. You've got the tools you need right at your fingertips. I open up my Yahoo Finance, and within seconds, I can see how my stocks and investments are doing. And basically, investing, it's all about growth. And in order to grow, you need to know what's going on. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com. As for the ongoing ground war, the Soviets did what they did best after focusing the resources of the state, including people, on a problem. They reorganized, i.e. focused, their overall defensive structure in command and areas of responsibility. Keeping the lay of the land rather simple, think of a half-circle protractor with Odessa at the center of its flat base. Of course, that protractor has to be tilted a bit to the left to capture the nature of the geographic coastline. On August 13th, Army Commander General Safronov broke his entire area into three sections. The eastern sector to the north of the city that went from the Kazibi estuary, that is the closer of the two smaller estuaries to the north of Odessa, given the way the coastline goes to the southeast to the coastline at Privrsep. Think due north of Odessa, but basically the almost land bridge leading to Odessa from the estuary right above the city. The length to be shielded was about 40 kilometers and was manned by the 54th Rifle Regiment, the 1st Regiment of the Navy Infantry, the 26th NKVD Composite Border Guards Regiment, and a rifle battalion of the 136th Reserve Regiment. All of these were placed under the command of S.F. Monakov. The western sector, but for us, we should think of it as the northern sector, as it ran from the eastern sector to the southwest, thus parallel to the port city itself, until it came to the Dniestr estuary. For continuity, we will call it the western sector as it is relative to the lay of the land, but it is to the northwest of Odessa. This section was commanded by Major General V.F. Vorobev, commander of the 95th Rifle Division. He had under him the 90th, 161st, and 241st Rifle Regiments of his 95th Rifle Division, as well as the 1st Machine Gun Battalion of the Tiraspol Fortified District, which leaves the third and final sector, the southern sector. On a negative side, it was the longest of the sectors, but on a positive side, the majority of it was covered by the Dniester estuary. Thus, the invaders would have to cross water to get to the defenders and be in the open while doing so. They cover the estuary plus the land bridge below it that led to the coast. Commanding this sector was Colonel A.S. Zakharov and his 25th Rifle Division, along with the 2nd Composite Machine Gun Battalion of the Tiraspol Fortified District. There were units in reserve, of course, for when the enemy came and a breakthrough seemed possible. On that note, the naval guns in the area were also assigned sections to lob shells at their sector should the need arise. The various air forces were given specific areas as well, but considering how small, overall, the Odessa area was, each section would pitch in, if needed, and they would be needed. And the fighting in the air thus far had been just as intense as the fighting on the ground. Having said that, the airstrips on land began to disappear as the Axis forces moved in. Soon, it was mostly up to naval-based fighters to defend the skies. Proper airfields would soon be further and further away as the Germans continued to push east. Back on August 8th, a flight commander had flown right at a German bomber formation. The Soviet pilot shot down the closest bomber, and the rest turned for home, having no escort, that is, as no Russian fighters were expected. The next day, August 9th, two Soviet pilots spotted 9 Junker bombers and flew into their path to disrupt their bomb run. It didn't hurt that the lead bomber was also taken out. Now that the race was on, but the bombers had not yet dropped their loads, so their extra weight allowed the fighters to catch up to them. Soon, another bomber was heading down for the last time. Now the remaining bombers dropped their loads and sped up, but not before a third bomber was lost. Just then, 4 Messerschmitts joined the fray, as did 2 more Soviet fighters. The flight element's leader, Lieutenant Zakharov, flew at the German fighters to keep them busy, but he paid the price. Soon his cockpit was damaged beyond hope. He too went down for the last time. But the dogfight wasn't over just yet. Soon, 6 more Soviet fighters came into view. Perhaps overconfident by their numbers, a Captain Kolobov was soon heading down as well, but the Messerschmitt that did him in was quickly damaged. But when the pilot Danchenko had been shooting at the German fighter, 2 more of them had pounced on him. Soon his engine was shut down, but he still had nominal control. Going in for a forced landing, the two Messerschmitts followed him down to finish him off. Not exactly cricket, but this left them open to two more Soviet fighters following them down. Within seconds, one of those German planes was smoking, followed by fire. As this German air attack had already cost three bombers and three Messerschmitts with nothing to show for it, the remaining aircraft turned for home. Perhaps thinking their luck would be better if they attacked from the sea, the next day, August 10th, Luftwaffe fighters approached from the south. But such was the alert lookouts, the incoming threat was spotted, and fighters from the 9th Fighter Aviation Regiment were soon in the air. Lieutenant Karpetkov downed one of the attackers on his very first pass, followed by a satisfying splash. Then, two other Soviet pilots double-teamed another Messerschmitt, ending with the same result. This was clearly not the weak spot the invaders were hoping for. The rest of the air threat turned for home. Perhaps taking a break would lower the vigilance of the lookouts. So, 2 days later, August 12th, more German bombers returned. But as before, a bomber was taken out even before getting over Odessa. And then when a second bomber splashed into the Black Sea, the rest went back the way they came. These failed attempts followed for a few more days. In fact, the Soviet fighters were able to down enemy planes while even further away from Odessa. This gave the Soviet political machinery of Odessa time to assess their true weak spots in terms of ground troops and bringing up some of the Party Youth members to the front lines. But less tangible, the Soviet apparatus was given time to build their numbers as well, and through various media channels, they not only reminded the men and women on the front line what they were fighting for, but that victory was possible as long as everyone did their part to the utmost. Not wasting the time gained by these various local defensive victories in the air and on the ground, the local committees went over and over every aspect of their ability to defend. Nothing was to be left out. This was mainly due to thinking they were facing overwhelming odds, and it was only a matter of time before all was lost. Thus, there was no such thing as too much intelligent defense and defense in depth. One area that was improved was the recovery and repair of any kind of weapon. The reoccurring question in those early days of August was, how can we be doing this better? As for those young communist members or those who had never fought before, first, they were given basic instruction and put together in groups of 1,200 men. What followed was a series of duties that started with guarding the immediate lines near Odessa, but moving closer to the front after a cycle. By the time they reached the front, the outermost line, they had seen and experienced much. It would have to do. Going back to the air war, with the Germans launching 12 to 15 air raids a day, some did get through. As this was unavoidable, the city officials were equally thorough with their fire brigades and rescue squads. A part of this response to the air threat was to dig almost 5,000 trenches for people to lie in during an air raid.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
On August 15th, the Southern Front's military council made a tour of the front lines and then thanked everyone for everything they had done. It ended with mentioning the thousands of fascist bodies seen, along with their officers, in front of the northeastern section of the outermost line. The implied message was, there was plenty room for more. The Romanians must have also noticed their war dead, with nothing to show for it. Clearly, a change was needed. So instead of coming from the northeast, relative to Odessa, they would now shift their axis to the northwest. Further, there was also to be a general offensive along the entire defensive line. If the northwestern section broke, all to the good. But at the very least, if the two ends near the coast could be pushed in a bit, then Odessa's port facilities would come within artillery range, and to destroy the city's ability to load and unload ships would be the beginning of their end. The Romanians brought up their reserves. During all this fighting so far on the ground, the Axis had 7 infantry divisions, 1 tank brigade, and 2 cavalry brigades. Soon, 2 more infantry divisions and another cavalry brigade were on their way. When the reserves arrived, the attack plan had to be changed again due to geography. The tanks would come from the northeast as the ground was better suited for them there. On August 15th, the latest attack got underway. Sure enough, the Romanian 15th Infantry Division and the 1st Cavalry Brigade attacked from the east, supported by a large number of tanks and air support. This area was defended by less than 1 full division, yet Brigadier Commander Monakov urged his men to fight. This overwhelming thrust came right at the men of the 1st Regiment of Naval Infantry, commanded by a veteran, Colonel Osipov. Wave after wave of men and tanks hit the line. Behind this main point, the Luftwaffe bombed the reserves waiting to feed themselves into the fray. This went on until after sunset. And then the inevitable happened. 2 battalions of Romanian infantry with tank support broke through and took a section of the line and its rear area. This looked like the beginning of the end, where the entire defensive position of Odessa was about to be unraveled like an onion. To wit, Osipov must have said, "Not on my watch." He gathered what men he could, and he counterattacked. Of course, this was not all about bravado. Before they moved out, Osipov had been in contact with a destroyer and a gunboat on the Black Sea, and he gave them coordinates to fire on. The ship's large turrets let loose for a while, and then the defenders rushed forward. And such was their intensity that 1 Romanian battalion was actually driven into the estuary behind them, and many drowned. But there was still another battalion and tanks to deal with, more than enough to cause havoc among the defenders. But they were dealt with by 1 man, a sailor named S. Klemenko. Having used the darkness to get in behind the remaining attackers, he waited until well-positioned, with a line of enemy troops just ahead of him, and then he raised his light machine gun. Spraying bullets from right to left, enemy troops were falling like pins in the dozens. The rest weren't exactly sure what was going on, but they saw their comrades fall in front of them. The survivors ran back to the north. As for the tanks, without infantry support, they knew they were vulnerable, so they made their own hasty retreat. And just like that, this latest threat was over. But the German-driven Romanians were not done attacking, and they would be back with more tanks, and there would be more breakthroughs, specifically at this same location. The thinking was the defenders here would be undermanned and weakened. But Colonel Osipov of the 1st Regiment of Naval Infantry had formed a plan for if the enemy returned here in strength. They did, and he put his plan into action. Greetings, everyone, from Central Virginia. So I just want to say hi to some members and thank those who have donated. Let's see here. Today is the day of the eclipse, so good luck with all that. Please don't lose your sight. Let's see here. The first member is Daniel Mello from Brazil, a cardiologist. He wrote a rather cheeky email hoping that I had to get a stress test done this morning. He said something like, "I hope the shaving of your chest was the worst part of it." I don't know if it was the worst, but it was pretty bad. So now I've got a spotty chest at best. My girls think it's funny. I might just have to shave everything just to start all over again. But those are my problems. I don't even know why I told you. Let's see here. Ryan Brophy from Utah. And Ryan, that is like the coolest last name ever. So good on ya. Let's see here. John Richards from St. Louis, Missouri. Thank you very much, John. Pamela Zeman from San Marcos, California. Thank you very much, Pamela. And donations, David Cavilla, if I'm saying that right, from UK, he wrote a very lovely supportive email. Thank you very much, David. Your donation helped pay for my copay. So I normally would use it for, you know, something like alcohol, but, you know, needs must. So thank you very much, David. So we will see what happens next with Odessa, and then we'll move on from there. Thank you, everyone, for listening and for supporting, and I will see you as soon as I can with the next episode. Take care, everyone.